It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, we'll meet two Wisconsin researchers who are weaving solar power into our lives, literally, with a solar textile project. First, in a post-Citizens United world where monetary donations are considered a form of political speech, do laws that force some nonprofits to disclose their donors constitute a suppression of speech? That's what State Director of Americans for Prosperity Eric Bott says in a recent editorial in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote that public disclosure laws could jeopardize free speech here in Wisconsin. He's with us now to lay out the case. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, make the basic argument here. How exactly is free speech under attack from the idea of public disclosure laws?
Sure. Well, let's take a step back and frame the issue. What we're really talking about here is the regulation of a very narrow form of political speech known as issue advocacy. And issue advocacy is not direct communications from campaigns, and that is regulated, and donations to those efforts are disclosed. And it's not express advocacy. It's not the super PACs that we hear about. Generally speaking, those activities are also disclosed. What issue advocacy is a very small portion of the political spending in the country, about 4.5% of all dollars spent, and it's groups like the League of Conservation Voters or Americans for Prosperity or Planned Parenthood that talk about policies and talk about the positions that politicians sometimes take on those policies. And so it's a different type of speech than the typical campaign speech we're often talking about. And the reason that the government reporting of people's private giving to these organizations is problematic is really threefold. Number one, there's academic literature simply doesn't back up the fact that it increases transportation or transparency or voter awareness of issues. In fact, we've seen multiple publications come out that show that there's virtually no marginal benefit for the average voter. The people that are benefited by these disclosure laws or government reporting laws are typically political operatives who can then utilize that information to either spin a false narrative or to somehow harass and intimidate their political opponents. And then number two, we see that there are actually benefits to issue advocacy, well established, that issue advocacy groups that get together, contribute money, and talk about policy increases voter knowledge of issues and increases voter turnout, which I think are both very valuable things in this country. As we've seen across the country recently, and I think increasingly, unfortunately, is that as states have passed laws requiring the disclosure of donor information for issue advocacy groups on both the left and right, we've seen a lot of incidences of harassment and intimidation. And I think that has an effect to chill speech and is a real danger that policymakers need to consider.
So the two different types of groups you're talking about, if a group says vote for or against candidate X and I donate money, that's disclosed, as I understand it. But if the group says candidate X has done a terrible job on the economy and that's all they do, then there's no disclosure there. Is that right?
That's the case right now in Wisconsin and is the case in many states around the country. And it may not even, the speech actually may not even involve a candidate's name whatsoever. It could just be an organization getting together to talk about any particular issue that they believe firmly in. And then that, you know, as some people have proposed, that would then be regulated and subject to disclosure of who's been donating money to those organizations.
But looking at two ads run on the same day, one ends with the phrase "vote for candidate X," the other just says "this candidate's doing a great job," .. and it's election season. From the voter's perspective, are they really that different?
Well, you know, from the Supreme Court's perspective, they are very, very different, and I think it's really important that the courts have recognized that they are different. The courts in this country have long held that the only legitimate purpose to regulate and impose burdens on the freedom of speech and the freedom of American citizens to assemble and petition their government is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. And that's a very fine limitation, and it's important that we don't overburden political speech, as it's some of the most important speech that we have to protect in this country. And so it's critical that we allow people to get together in groups and talk about what they believe, and that includes spending money to educate other people about what they believe, and that's a very important part of our political discourse. And, you know, one of the other groups that really tends to benefit, and people ought to consider this, a group that really benefits from this type of regulation is incumbent politicians. And that's where we as a group like Americans for Prosperity often are concerned. One of the things we do is hold politicians accountable, and if you followed our work in Wisconsin lately, we've often been holding Republican politicians accountable for the promises they make to their constituents and for the positions they take on policies. And that's not always popular, right? And so politicians will oftentimes turn to these types of regulations to try to chill speech and chill the activities of organizations that speak to power and that try to hold them accountable. And so anytime we're going to have, we're going to face any type of regulation that's going to limit the ability of citizens to get together and hold politicians accountable, we want to be very suspect of that.
Talking to Eric Bott from Americans for Prosperity here in Wisconsin about an op-ed he wrote on the idea of requiring public disclosure of donations to what are often called issue advocacy groups that spend money on political issues and advertising related to that. But Eric, if we have this disclosure, it doesn't limit really anyone's speech. It's not the government limiting someone's speech. They can still make that donation, and ultimately it provides the voters, the public, with more information about who's supporting what. How's that bad?
Well, what we've seen in states like California that have advanced these sort of government reporting laws are a lot of consequences for people. There's a woman named Marjorie Christofferson who managed a restaurant in California called the El Coyote. She gave a $100 donation to support a ballot initiative, and people found her information, her personal information, her name, her address, her home address, her employer, and her position, and they protested her restaurant. And for the sake of that business, she had to resign her position. So a woman lost her job over $100. Another gentleman named Scott Eckern, who managed a musical theater in California, he gave a $1,000 contribution to a ballot initiative. And again, under California's disclosure law, his name, his personal information, his address, his employer, that was all made publicly known to his political opponents, the people that disagreed with his position. And he, too, lost his job. We've seen people, you know, Jean Kokenauer was a miner, a very famous case now in West Virginia. She refused her boss's order to give a donation to a Republican and was fired from her job. And it's, I think, really terrible that we see more and more of these cases across the country where people are having their lives ruined. They're losing their jobs over a political belief or a position they take on a given issue. So there are real-world consequences to these sorts of laws. And one of the other problems we see is what we call junk disclosure. Oftentimes people will take very complicated information and presented in such a way as to convey the goal that they intended, advance their political cause. And it may not really give the public good information. So you'll see, someone report that, such and such a company gave a political candidate $50,000, when that may well be actually illegal. And in reality, what happened was that individual employees on their own chose to make those donations. And so it's really disingenuous to report as if a business gave those dollars when it was individuals making that decision. So does that information really benefit the public? I don't think so. And so there are real consequences here. And again, it gets back to, if the justification is transparency, well, where do the studies lead us? And the academic literature is pretty clear. Regular voters don't go and look at this information. It's viewed by politicians, the political elite, and operatives who then use it usually for negative and nefarious purposes.
And you mentioned earlier the concern of corruption. If I have a way to make, a secret donation, an undisclosed donation on behalf of a candidate, and the candidate can know that, and then they're passing legislation later on that benefits me or affects me in some way, shouldn't the public know about that and see if there's some kind of quid pro quo going on?
Well, in the case of issue advocacy, that would be unlawful coordination. And
but how do we know to investigate it if we don't know who made the donation?
Well, the politicians are, they're going to continue to do what they're going to do. And from the perspective of an organization that talks about issues, what's absolutely critical is that we continue to have the right and that our members across the state continue to have the right to talk, to have their voices heard, and to talk about the policies that they believe in. And that comes first and foremost. And that sort of activity is currently illegal, and organizations are very closely regulated by both state regulators like the GAB in the state of Wisconsin and the Federal Elections Commission.
Are you concerned, given your worries about these disclosure laws, that this would happen in Wisconsin anytime soon?
Politicians in Wisconsin, both Republican and Democrat, have made calls for various types of government reporting requirements. And so it's always something that we're concerned with, particularly going into this fall legislative session when we know that campaign finance reform is first and foremost in the minds of a lot of elected officials in the state. It's something that we're watching very closely.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That's Eric Bott, Wisconsin State Director of Americans for Prosperity. He recently wrote an editorial in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying that laws that force certain nonprofits, issue advocacy groups, to disclose their donors is a threat to free speech. First, when we think of solar power, the first thing that pops into my mind is the shiny, glassy-looking solar panel up on a roof somewhere. That's one way to turn the sun's power into usable energy, but what if we could harness that power with a tent, or with our curtains, or a sail, or our clothes? Our next guests are working together to develop solar collecting textiles. Tricia Andrew is an assistant professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. Tricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Marianne Fairbanks is assistant professor of design studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Marianne, how did this project get started?
Well, I had a company several years ago that integrated flexible thin film solar panels into handbags and backpacks and such. And from trying to integrate these flexible panels that are rigid and sort of rectangular, I'd always sort of dreamed that the whole surface could become the collecting agent for the solar power. And so it was something always in the back of my mind. And when I got here to campus last fall for my new job, I sort of looked online to see what research was being done. And that's when I came across Tricia.
Okay. And then Tricia, this textile expert comes to you with this idea, solar textiles. What were some of your thoughts on how to tackle the problem?
So Marianne basically found me because of a previous bit of work my lab was doing on making solar cells on paper. And so my lab basically uses commodity dyes that are in car paints in order to collect the light. So they're actually the solar cell instead of the purple silicon that you see on the rooftops in the panels that you mentioned earlier. And we use this other process called oxidative chemical vapor deposition to basically electrify the paper or any substrate that you want, anything under the sun, to serve as one of the collecting electrodes for the final device. And so we had made this initial panel on paper for being cutesy, and that's when Marianne found me, and she found me at a time where I was not really sure where to go forward with it, because you're not really reading a paper in the morning wishing you had a solar cell on that paper. And so when she came to me and she brought this idea of having solar panels integrated into textiles, that was honestly the first time I ever thought about fabrics in general. And that became actually something very, very interesting, because now you could think about making solar cells, solar textiles that you could put on windows, so curtains that will actually harvest the energy that is on the window, or even conductive textiles for tents or kind of camping purposes, and then for defense applications where you could have soldier uniforms or something like that that can actually collect energy and power very low energy devices.
And now I've seen examples of at least concepts of solar clothing, and Marianne, you mentioned solar handbags, but again, it's that rigid stuff, maybe it's a flap that comes up. Why is it important to have it integrated into the very fabric of the fabric of the product?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. I think one reason I'm excited is just because it's lightweight and totally integrated. The idea that this could change the face of how solar is produced or manufactured, I think is what's really revolutionary and really exciting about the possibilities that, you know, solar's kind of been stuck for a while in these very expensive production methods. And so to link up with a totally different process like textiles and sort of use some of that manufacturing could change the face of solar. But also just, being a textiles enthusiast, like I love the idea that it can be foldable, totally integrated, not this rigid, thick thing, but something that's, you know, a tent or an umbrella, something that could cover anything, coat anything, wrap anything. I just think it's just so exciting.
And Tricia, it seems like part of the challenge is, as Marianne said, not just to make this and make it work, but to make it cheap and easy to manufacture. How big a factor is that? How big an obstacle is that in your research on this?
In my research, that is basically the number one question facing scientists and engineers. Is it's not really developing the technology, because in 2015, the technology is there. There's actually many solutions to how do you harvest the sun's energy. The problem really is how do you do it cheaply and in a very cost-effective, high-throughput manner that can become something that's easily accessible to the layman. And so this idea of really investigating manufacturing technologies is very revolutionary. It's actually high impact. And no one really invokes threading or weaving or anything very rudimentary like that in order to manufacture devices, because you really can't even fathom something like that for a sophisticated technological application like a solar cell. And that's where this project really comes in, where we're, for the very first time, even just allowing people to envision the ability to weave a solar cell together.
Talking to Tricia Andrew and Marianne Fairbanks from the UW-Madison about their efforts to create solar power collecting textiles. And I want to, Marianne, pick up on that last point. Because if we solve that problem of how to weave with solar collecting cells, we know how to manufacture a lot of the stuff with textiles, right? If we can get past that basic point, we can do a lot of stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's sort of exciting because on my end, I'm working in a lab where we have... it's a very sophisticated loom where we can control any thread of 1,760 threads.
Wow.
So for me, I can go in and design a weave structure, design it in layers, design it with all of these capabilities, and then think about how these threads are going to perform their different duties in those positions within the weave structure. And so I just think that it's sort of thinking through this high-tech cloth in a different way for a different function.
And Tricia, with that in mind, what kind of experiments are you doing to figure out how the threads pull together to make this happen?
Well, so I have a very, very awesome graduate student who I was lucky to recruit into my lab, Lushui Zhang. I'm just going to drop her name here. And she's already pushed this project so far. So we're really close to actually having a functional solar cell that's directly integrated, monolithically integrated onto a piece of fabric. And that does not involve a weaving process. So we start with samples that Marianne gets us, and we just built the solar cell directly on there, which is very exciting to start with. And then on the weaving aspect of actually building and assembling Lego style a solar cell together using a weaving technique, what we have now are different threads of each of the components. And as I like to describe a solar cell, it's sort of like a sandwich. There's two pieces of bread, there's a piece of meat, and a piece of cheese. And so we have each of those components that are deposited onto threads. And so now we need to just make the sandwich together.
Now, I guess on a practical level, all right, say this works, and we've got our tent or my shirt or something like that. It's out in the sun. It's producing electricity. What do I do with it? How do I make that go from the shirt solar cell into something?
Well, that's a great question because I think it's a stumbling block for a lot of solar applications, and it has to do with battery. So we will need batteries to hold the harvested energy and then deploy it to whatever you would like to charge, right? Because we need to capture it. We don't want that power right when it's sunny. We want it later when it's dark. And so holding it in the battery is important. I've been really excited about the battery research that's also happening these days. Where it's flexible batteries are also in development. So, if you think about technologies like that being married with something like this, then we have a flexible battery and a flexible solar cell. I mean, it really could change everything.
Right. A flexible battery, I'm not kidding. So this is... What would that be like? How would a flexible battery work?
Well, in the same way that I think we're looking at what can be deposited onto textiles, I think other researchers are also investigating how to capture energy. Is there any reason that the chemicals need to be in a case? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's the research
Wow.
that I've been looking to.
Mind-blowing stuff. Now, Tricia, as a chemist, are you learning more about weaving than you ever would have expected to?
No, absolutely. I mean, Marianne came into my office, and our best device right now is something built on banana fiber or pineapple fiber, which I grew up in the third world, and I was familiar with that, but I never really thought about it for a long time until Marianne invoked this, and I was like, wait, that sounds familiar. Oh, that's the Philippine fabric, right? And it turned out that our best devices are basically built on biomass derived pineapple fabric. And so, who else sits there in a conversation and suggests pineapple fabric as an answer? No one I know other than Marianne. So.
And Marianne, same question reverse. Are you learning more about chemistry than you thought going into your profession?
Unfortunately.
No, it's been amazing. One of the things that attracted me to Tricia's process was it said organic dye-based solar cell. And, a few lights went off in my head, and I thought, well, I know dyes. I dye things in indigo. I use chemical dyes on fabric all the time. I know what she's talking about. And so in our first meeting, I was asking her about dyes, and I said, well, the dyes you're using are blue. Could this be indigo? And then Tricia explained to me the, chemical components of indigo and why it wouldn't work. And I never had understood exactly
Wow.
how indigo worked before. And so having that conversation with Tricia where I can do it with my hands and she can tell me exactly how it's working on a chemical basis was really exciting.
I know this kind of thing can be hard to predict, but do you have a time span in mind where consumers might be able to get a wearable, say, solar cell or some kind of solar fabric and be using it to charge their phone or something like that? Either of you.
Well, we got a grant for this research, and one of our goals is in the spring of 2016 to just build this successful device on a textile substrate. The actual integrating of the woven process is sort of down the road from that, and we'll have to do with more funding and more research. But I think it's within the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think we can have a prototype in a lab type prototype in a few months, and then commercialization is another issue.
Amazing. Thank you, Tricia, so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Marianne, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Tricia Andrew, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, and Marianne Fairbanks, Assistant Professor of Design Studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, about their work on solar power collecting textiles. We learned this week that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin has agreed to form a joint fundraising venture with Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Wisconsin is one of four states so far to have a state Democratic Party enter that kind of deal with the Clinton campaign. It's a strategy our next guest says isn't necessarily uncommon in American politics. The timing of the announcement months before the party actually nominates a candidate is a bit unusual, though. All this comes at an interesting time for campaign finance, as recent Supreme Court rulings have made it easier for more money to flow into elections. How's this all going to play out in the coming months? Ken Mayer is with us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison who studies campaign finance. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with some background. This concept of joint fundraising sounds simple, but it's campaign finance law, so I assume it's not. What are we talking about here?
The federal law allows candidates, interest groups, basically any type of political committee to enter into joint fundraising agreements, which essentially allow them to raise money together. And the key feature of these agreements is that there has to be a written agreement between the organizations about allocating the money that they raise. They're actually very common. There were over 500 of them in 2014, another 500 in 2012. So they are a routine part of the campaign finance landscape. What makes this a little unusual and what had people scratching their heads is why the Democratic Party, the state parties, agreed to do this with the Clinton campaign even before the nomination process had even kicked off formally. I mean, we're still 5 months out of the first primaries and caucuses. And it turns out we know a little bit more now than we did yesterday. The Washington Post reported that the agreement between Clinton and these various parties and the DNC allows them to raise money now, but it will be spent in the general election on whomever gets the nomination. So it doesn't appear, based on the reports, that this is anything that's going to happen before the nomination is settled.
Right, because some of the gut reaction from some people was, wait, is this an early anointing of a candidate by these four state Democratic parties? Maybe not, but at least in this sense, it isn't just benefiting the Hillary Clinton campaign itself.
Right. So again, the unusual element here is the timing, and the state parties and the DNC have all made it clear that they would sign agreements with any candidate. Again, the Post reported that the DNC would like to have these agreements signed with all 50 state parties. So at this point, it really is a fundraising mechanism that allows the candidates and the state parties and national parties to raise money together. It begins to look a little bit like what soft money looked like in the 1990s, but it's not unusual.
And it sounds like very clearly this money wouldn't be spent on behalf of Hillary Clinton's primary campaign, which would, I assume, really tick off other Democrats in the party who opposed her.
It certainly, based on the reports, and I haven't seen the agreement, but that seems to be correct.
Now, you mentioned this isn't new. Can you go back a little bit to where this got started?
Well, as best as I can tell, the first notice that I found in federal law for joint fundraising committees were in the 1970s, so I trace it back to the Federal Election Campaign Act. And what it allows is there are all kinds of complicated questions that arise when candidates and their supporters or a corporate political action committee that also belongs to a trade association, that the relationships between groups and candidates and among groups are very complicated and the arrows go in all different directions. And this allows different groups to cooperate in raising money. They can't do anything with the money that they wouldn't otherwise be permitted to to do under federal law. So it's not as if this joint fundraising committee between the Clinton campaign and the DNC or the Wisconsin Democratic Party can morph into a super PAC in which individuals can give unlimited amounts of money. The amounts of money that individuals can give to the candidates and to the parties are still limited by federal law. But it's a way of leveraging and making it easier for candidates and parties to work together.
But those amounts are limited less than they used to be now, right? Because we've talked about, while individual donation limits are still in place, the aggregate donation limit, if I want to donate to 50 or 100 candidates, that aggregate donation limit is not what it used to be, or is not there now, right?
That's correct. Prior to a Supreme Court decision from last year, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, there was an aggregate limit of about $120,000 or so that an individual could give to all federal candidates and all federal committees, parties, interest groups, and so forth. And what McCutcheon did, what that decision did, is eliminate those caps. And so an individual can give the maximum amount to a candidate. To a candidate's about $2,600, $5,000 to a political action committee, and varying levels, and a few tens of thousands of dollars to parties. But they can do that to an unlimited number of groups. And there's an appendix to the McCutcheon decision where Stephen Breyer, Justice Breyer, mapped out some possibilities in which an individual could give millions of dollars to all of the candidates, parties, and interest groups in the course of a single cycle. And that's what I think is being leveraged here, that an individual who has given money to candidates and to parties can give them to as many parties and candidates as he or she wants.
Talking to UW political scientist Ken Mayer right now about campaign finance. Specifically, we're starting off with this joint finance agreement, or joint fundraising agreement, I should say, between Hillary Clinton and the state Democratic parties in Wisconsin and three other states. A fairly common arrangement, he says. We'll get into some wider campaign finance issues in a bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your concerns and your questions about how all this works. One question, people have been doing this a long time. It's got to benefit somebody. Do candidates make out well? Does this work out well for state parties or the other parties involved in these joint fundraising agreements?
Well, it seems to me that when a party enters into one of these arrangements, that it benefits the party because they are the candidates can raise as much money as they need to as they like. But it depends entirely on the nature of the agreement. For example, in 2008. The McCain campaign, the presidential campaign, entered into a joint fundraising agreement with the National Party, but about 95% of that money that was raised went to the McCain campaign, and only a few percentage points went to the party. So it all depends on the allocation formula, again, which has to be written, but I've never seen one of these agreements, so I don't know what the allocation formula is.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daniel is on the line with us in Madison. Daniel, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Daniel?
Okay, so I get the point that was made by the about this arrangement being more to likely set aside money for the general election rather than to help a particular candidate at the primaries. I understand. I'm wondering if the agreement made might have some bearing on a candidate, in this case Hillary Clinton's, access to state donor information that her operation might not otherwise have, giving her an advantage maybe in that way that another candidate, say Martin O'Malley or Bernie Sanders, might not get if they don't enter into such an arrangement.
Well, interesting, Daniel. Do we know anything about how that information sharing might work in a deal like this, even if we don't know the specifics of this deal?
Well, that's an interesting question. There would be nothing that would prohibit a state party from turning that information over in any event, because parties and candidates can do lots of things together. Without having seen the agreement, I don't know whether that's part of it. I suspect, just based on the contours of what parties and candidates do, that's not a central reason why they're doing it. If the state party wanted to give her the information, they could do it even without a joint fundraising agreement, I believe. And there may be reasons for parties to be a little bit cautious about that because they want to maintain control of that for their own purposes and make sure that their donor base doesn't get tapped out giving all the money to candidates and there's nothing left over for the state party. But that you get into the weeds very deeply, very quickly when you're dealing with these kinds of issues.
For a national campaign, say a presidential campaign, you hear about, you know, fundraising visits often to coasts, places with lots of wealthy people. Is Wisconsin really on the map when it comes to national fundraising?
Milwaukee is a little bit. We are in the orbit of Chicago, and so frequently what might happen is a Democratic candidate wants to come to Chicago and raise some money, and they'll do a toe tap in Milwaukee to pick up a little bit more. I think it has more to do, the candidates raise money where they find the money. So for a Democratic candidate, it's New York, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Chicago. It's the big cities, which is where the most people are and where you have concentrations of wealth. And for Republicans, it's the same sort of thing, Dallas, Houston, the big cities. Fundraising is a little bit different than the Electoral College strategy, so a candidate will be coming to Wisconsin in the course of the general election campaign, not so much to raise money, but because Wisconsin is likely to be in play.
We're talking with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, talking about campaign finance and the presidential election. A starting point, this joint fundraising venture reached between candidate Hillary Clinton and Wisconsin's Democratic Party, along with three other states. And bigger picture, we'll get into how campaign finance is playing out so far in this election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this joint fundraising venture idea this early, before any votes have been cast at caucuses or primaries? When it comes to campaign finance and money in this election cycle, what questions do you have? What hopes and fears do you have as to the role money will play in the presidential race 2016? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking now with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at campaign finance and the presidential race, this joint financing venture reached between presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and our state's Democratic Party, and more generally, how campaign finance is playing out so far in this election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this deal we've been talking about and on money in politics of the presidential race in general? Call 800-642-1234. 1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Ken, we've got a new landscape, a lot of people are saying, with recent Supreme Court decisions on money in politics. What's been the big story so far as we approach primary season?
Well, the big story is that apart from individual contribution limits to candidates, the federal campaign finance landscape has been completely deregulated. We're now in a situation where individuals and corporations, although corporations tend not to do a lot of this, but individuals and corporations can make unlimited contributions to independent groups. There's no limit to the number of contributions an individual can make to candidates. The proliferation of tax-exempt groups, 501c3s and c4s, and the interlocking relationships among these groups makes it very difficult to track who is ultimately giving the money, where it's coming from. So we have essentially deregulated, or the Supreme Court has deregulated the process, and it's a new kind of world. Just to give one example of what the practical consequences are, there are 17 Republican candidates for the Republican nomination. A couple of them are essentially out of money. There are reports that Rick Perry in particular has stopped paying his staffers because they have been unable to raise significant amounts of money. But he has a super PAC that has $10 million in the bank. So even though he can't pay his supporters and may not be able to pay for a campaign plane, if it gets to that point, this super PAC, which is independent functionally, although there are questions about how ironclad those separations are, he could be on the air and be continuing to run. And that's going to be, I think, a pattern for lots of candidates who 20 years ago or even 10 years ago would have been forced to drop out, but they're still going to stick around.
Well, to that issue, a lot of eyes are on Wisconsin and our Supreme Court decision on coordination. Now, if that were a precedent, limits on campaign coordination between candidates and outside groups has been deregulated somewhat here. Would that affect a situation with a super PAC, though, like Rick Perry's that you just mentioned and his campaign? Could they could they work together, essentially spend from over there to over here for the candidate?
The short answer is no, because that Supreme Court decision only dealt with state law. That then they interpreted the federal constitution to allow certain sorts of things. I think that ruling was incorrect, and there is some chance that it will be appealed to the Supreme Court. But that has no bearing on federal activities, which is governed by federal law, which prohibit those kinds of coordinations. Now, there are groups that are seeking to have the coordination rules overturned at the federal level, but we're not there yet.
And also, that's the state one, I think, was issue advocacy groups, not super PACs that directly said vote for or vote against.
Right.
So that's a little different, too.
So the old rule was that the first question that you asked is, were you coordinating? If you were coordinating, then everything you did was a contribution, even if it was issue advocacy, express advocacy, it didn't matter. And what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said is that's the wrong order, that the first thing you need to ask is it issue advocacy or express advocacy? And if it's issue advocacy, it's entirely outside the scope of regulation, which is a novel and, I think, incorrect reading of the constitutional provisions about campaign finance.
Let's go back to a caller as we talk campaign finance with UW-Madison political scientist Ken Mayer. We've got Rick on the line at 800-642-1234. Rick calling from Green Bay. Rick, hi.
Hi, Ken, I have a question. Is there a maximum dollar amount now that we're in the era of essentially unlimited spending beyond which the candidates get no bang for their buck?
That is an incredibly interesting question. There's no easy answer to that. One of the things we do know is that there are diminishing returns, that the difference between, say, $100 and $10 million is huge. The difference between $10 million and $20 million is significantly less, and so that the curve flattens out. On the other hand, and you also have the issue that the more voters you're going after, it becomes harder to communicate with and to mobilize the more marginally connected voters. Having said that, there are still things like get out the vote drives and voter contacts that are enormously labor intensive. That you spend more money, you can do more of them. Now, again, it's likely there that the marginal effect of an additional dollar decreases as the amounts go up. But I don't think we are close to at least the recognition among the people who are spending the money that we are at that point. I think part of what's driving this is a classic arms race dynamic where it may not be in your interest to spend the extra $10 or, in this case, $100 million, but if you don't spend it and the other side does, they win, they are better off, and so you both spend the $100 million and it essentially amounts to a push.
So we're not at a point where a candidate offered a campaign donation is going to say, no, we're good.
No. The demand for money is pretty close to infinite. What you can productively do with that probably goes down, but I don't think anybody knows where that inflection point actually is.
You mentioned specifically the McCutcheon U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier. Citizens United is something that people are still talking about a lot. How are we seeing that affect this year's election cycle?
Well, I actually think there's another federal court decision that is actually playing a bigger role in this dynamic than Citizens United. That was the case in 2010 where the Supreme Court held that corporations can't be prohibited from spending money on express advocacy. But there was another case at about the same time called Speech Now versus the Federal Election Commission, which dealt with there was a group that challenged the contribution limits to independent groups. So prior to that, if an individual wanted to give money to an independent group, there were contribution limits. And what Speech Now did, it was an appeals court that the Supreme Court refused to review. That did away with individual contribution limits. That's why Sheldon Adelson, other folks, George Soros, the Steyers, you can now give a $10, $50, $100, $200 million contribution to a super PAC, to an independent group, as long as it is independent of the campaign, the brakes are completely off.
And that's a case where one donor can sustain you in a primary campaign.
That's correct. Hmm. And you could have an individual who commits to you, again, as long as they're independent, but they can continue to spend money on your behalf. They can't give it to you. You can't use it to fund campaign activities. But given the amount of money that is spent on advertising, it could sustain a campaign pretty significantly.
Now let's throw a complete hypothetical out here for you. Say you've got a really rich person who decides they want to run for president and use some of their own money. Well, I'm talking about Donald Trump, obviously. Put a lot of their own money into it. How do campaign laws, campaign finance laws, affect self-funded campaigns?
The laws have never applied to self-funded campaigns. This goes back to Buckley versus Valeo in 1976 Supreme Court decision, where they held that you cannot limit the amount of money that an individual spends on his or her own campaign. And the reasoning is that, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, the only permissible reason for regulating campaign finance is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. An individual spending money on his own behalf or her own behalf can't be corrupted because there's nothing external to that. And so individuals can spend as much as they want. And this is why Trump could self-fund his campaign. It probably will not self-fund it all because he will be able to attract some money. But if he wanted to spend $1 billion running for president, he could.
It's impossible to corrupt ourselves. That's a very philosophical argument.
Well, that's the rationale. There are other reasons why that's a bad thing, I think, because it tends to distort the types of people who can run for office. But that's not really a policy issue. It's, as you put it, it's a philosophical issue, not so much a legal one.
So what are you looking for? What are you watching in the months leading up to, you know, actual votes being cast in Iowa, New Hampshire, and elsewhere when it comes to money and politics?
Well, it's difficult to say because as I tell my students, tell reporters that we've actually worked out pretty well the dynamics of a two-candidate race. You can predict what candidates are doing. It starts to fall apart with a three-candidate race with 17 candidates. It's essentially Brownian motion. There's no way to predict what's going to happen when someone drops. It's essentially chaos. And so the effects, I think, will be that a lot of candidates will stick around longer than they otherwise would have if this were 2004 or 1996.
Is it ever a case where a party is worried, hey, if we blow all our donated money in primary campaigns, we're not going to have enough juice left in the general election? Or are people keeping at least some powder dry for the actual event there?
Well, again, it depends on whether we're talking about the campaigns, the candidate organizations, or the super PACs. If it's the candidate organizations, you do run into problems if you have individuals who have maxed out. You can't go back to them for more money. With 17 candidates, I think there may be some issues where the pool of potential donors has been thinned out somewhat. But that doesn't have anything to do with the super PACs. As long as you have wealthy individuals of relatively small number who are willing to commit to a particular candidate, that seems to be less more inelastic.
Ken, as always, thanks for joining us and explaining the finer points of campaign finance law.
It's always a pleasure.
That's Ken Mayer. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about campaign finance in the ongoing presidential race.